From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have a black woman on the ticket. And after all of this organizing, making the case, helping to expand the imaginations of the American people, we have finally, the first in history, an opportunity to lead.
Joe Biden selects California Senator Kamala Harris to be his vice presidential running mate, making her the first black woman and the first Indian American to be on a major party presidential ticket. Harris is the daughter of immigrants, her father from Jamaica, her mother from India. We'll look at the historic choice with Amy Allison, founder of She the People, and Brianna Joy Gray, the former national press secretary for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Then we speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Isabel Wilkerson, author of the new book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents.
The term caste may be new to many of us, but anthropologists and sociologists who studied the Jim Crow South emerged from their research and found that to be the most appropriate word for that region of our country for more than 100 years of Jim Crow segregation. That's the word they chose to use, and that's the word I'm using and trying to unpack and trying to understand in this book.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Joe Biden has selected Senator Kamala Harris of California to be his vice presidential running mate, making her the first black woman and the first Indian American to be on a major party presidential ticket. Biden and Harris are scheduled to make their first joint appearance today in Wilmington, Delaware. In a tweet, Biden described Harris as, quote, fearless fighter for the little guy and one of the country's finest public servants. Kamala Harris has served in the Senate since 2017. She previously served as California's Attorney General for 6 years and as District Attorney of San Francisco for 7 years before that. While Harris has been credited with pushing criminal justice reform in the Senate, she's been criticized for her record as a prosecutor in California by progressives. Harris is the daughter of immigrants, her father from Jamaica, her mother from India. We'll have much more on Kamala Harris after headlines. Florida and Georgia have reported their highest daily death tolls since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, as the U.S. recorded nearly 1,300 new deaths from COVID-19 Tuesday. Texas and California reported near-record rates of infections, and Wisconsin passed the 1,000 death mark. The Big Ten and Pac-12 college athletic conferences each voted to postpone their fall sports seasons, including football games, a multi-billion-dollar industry and major source of revenue to universities. President Trump lashed out against the moves, telling Fox Sports Radio in an interview it would be a tragic mistake to cancel football in the fall. Meanwhile, in southwestern Georgia, a second prisoner at the Stewart Detention Center, a for-profit immigration jail, has died of COVID-19. The 70-year-old Costa Rican national, whose name hasn't been released, is the third asylum seeker to die in ICE custody in the last week alone. India reported more than 60,000 new coronavirus cases and 834 deaths Wednesday, nearly breaking a record set earlier this week, bringing India's official death toll to more than 46,000. Latin America remains the epicenter of the pandemic, with just 8% of the world's population and 30% of global deaths from COVID-19. In Bolivia, morgues in the city of La Paz are filled to capacity as bodies of COVID-19 victims have been left uncollected in an open-air spot near a local chapel. A police officer cited residents' fear of contracting the virus.
The majority of those bodies here at the morgue are people who died on the street. And for those who died at home, families have passed on funerary responsibilities because they fear coronavirus infection.
In election news, a supporter of a far-right conspiracy theory with a history of racist remarks has won the Republican nomination for Georgia's 14th congressional district. Marjorie Taylor Greene's primary victory Tuesday in a deep red district makes her the heavy favorite in November's election. Green ran on a pro-gun, anti-immigrant, anti-abortion platform and has embraced the QAnon conspiracy theory, which claims, among other things, that President Trump is secretly at war with a deep state cabal of Satan-worshipping elites who run a child sex trafficking operation. In videos posted to social media, Green voices support for Confederate monuments, calls black people slaves to the Democratic Party, claims billionaire philanthropist George Soros is a Nazi, and attacks Muslims elected to Congress.
There is an Islamic invasion into our government offices right now. Okay, they are. You saw after midterm elections what we saw: so many Muslims elected. I don't know the exact number, but there were quite a few. What, we had that woman out of Minnesota. Now she's going into Congress and she's got to wear a head covering.
In Minnesota, freshman Congressmember Ilhan Omar, one of three Muslims in Congress, defeated a well-funded challenger in Tuesday's primary elections. Antoine Melton Mew's campaign raised $3.2 million in the second quarter of 2020, seven times as much as Omar's campaign. Melton Mew had the support of two pro-Israel lobby groups that bundled 20% of its large donor dollar donations. He was also backed by two billionaires. Ilhan Omar, who's been outspoken in her support of Palestinian rights, celebrated her victory Tuesday by tweeting, quote, "Organized people will always beat organized money." She added, quote, "It's about standing up for basic human rights around the world and fighting a military-industrial complex that opposes the recognition of people's humanity and dignity," she said. The Democratic National Convention has unveiled its list of speakers for next week's convention, which will be held entirely online. Among marquee names are former President Barack Obama, former First Lady Michelle Obama, former President Bill Clinton, former Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich, and freshman New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Also scheduled to speak are Senators Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Cory Booker, as well as South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. We'll be playing highlights of the evening's convention each morning on Democracy Now! Next week. Kamala Harris will accept the nomination on Wednesday night. Joe Biden will accept his nomination on Thursday night. In Lebanon, mourners on Tuesday marked 1 week since a catastrophic explosion destroyed the port of Beirut, killing more than 220 people, injuring 7,000, leaving more than 250,000 residents homeless. Overnight, police fired tear gas at protesters who set fire to a gate leading to the parliament building. The mass resignation of Lebanon's top government officials on Monday has failed to quell anger over a crushing economic crisis, record rates of COVID-19 infections, and last week's catastrophic blast. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports an American contractor working with the U.S. Army warned over 4 years ago about the hazard posed by over 2,700 tons of explosive ammonium nitrate fertilizer left unattended at Beirut's port. The U.S. State Department reportedly then failed to pass along the warning to U.S. allies. In Mali, thousands of protesters flooded the capital, Bamako, Tuesday, demanding the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita amidst a financial crisis, widespread corruption and mounting violence from separatist groups. The protests were the biggest since July 10th, when the police opened fire on anti-government protesters, killing at least 11 people and wounding scores of others. In Chicago, a 20-year-old man who was shot at multiple times by police and charged with attempted murder for allegedly firing at police officers first is being held on $1 million bond. This comes as Southside Weekly reports there's no body cam footage or any video evidence of Latrell Allen allegedly shooting at police officers. Allen's brother, who was with him at the time of Sunday's shooting, told the Chicago Sun-Times his brother hadn't fired at police. Another witness told Southside Weekly a police vehicle drove toward Allen at high speed, jumping a curb, possibly causing Allen to panic and run. The shooting sparked massive protests in Chicago, where over 100 people were arrested overnight on Monday. In Aurora, Colorado, the family of Elijah McClain, the 23-year-old black young man who was killed by police last year, has filed a lawsuit against the officers and paramedics involved in his death. McLean was stopped by police August 24, 2019, as he was walking home from buying iced tea for his brother. He was tackled by police, placed in a chokehold, later injected with ketamine by paramedics. He died August 30th after days on life support. An online petition demanding justice for McLean has collected over 5 million signatures. In California, a viral video shows Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies detaining three teenagers at gunpoint after bystanders called 911 to report the teens were under attack by a man with a knife. Two of the three teens are African-American, and the arresting officers are white. Video of last Friday's incident in Santa Clarita shows two officers with handguns trained on the teens who have their hands above their heads. A third officer sights one of the teens through the scope of his assault rifle, his finger on the trigger. As bystanders protest that the deputies have the wrong suspects, the officer with the rifle shouts at them to back up.
Hey, get away from me. It's the other guy.
Put your guns down.
Keep your hands up.
Deputies detained the three teens in squad cars for about 30 minutes before releasing them without charge. Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva said in a brief statement on Twitter he had concerns regarding the tactics employed and that the officers' actions were under investigation. A Michigan judge has closed the case against a 15-year-old African-American student who had been sent to a juvenile jail in May after she failed to finish her schoolwork online. The girl, who's known simply as Grace, was released from custody in July and has now been removed from probation. And in labor news, a California judge has ordered Uber and Lyft to reclassify their drivers from independent contractors to employees. Monday's ruling forces Lyft and Uber to grant thousands of contract drivers the same protections and benefits under law as other company employees, including health insurance and paid sick leave. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York City, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez at his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we're beginning with the top news here in this country. Joe Biden has selected Senator Kamala Harris of California to be his vice presidential running mate, making her the first Black woman and the first Indian American to be on a major party presidential ticket. Kamala Harris is the daughter of immigrants, her father from Jamaica, her mother from India. Biden and Harris are scheduled to make their first appearance today in Wilmington, Delaware. Harris will officially accept her nomination next Wednesday during the Democratic National Convention. In a tweet, Biden described Harris as a, quote, fearless fighter for the little guy and one of the country's finest public servants. Kamala Harris had endorsed Biden in March after challenging him for the nomination.
I really believe in him, and I have known him for a long time. One of the things that we need right now is we need a leader who really does care about the people and who can therefore unify the people. And I believe Joe can do that.
Joe Biden picked Kamala Harris, even though the two sparred on the campaign trail. In the first Democratic debate last year, Harris criticized Biden over his comments about working with segregationists in the Senate and for his opposition to Delaware's attempts to bus students in an effort to integrate its schools in the 1970s.
I'm going to now direct this at Vice President Biden. I do not believe you are a racist. And I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it is personal, and I was actually it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
Kamala Harris has served in the Senate since 2017. She previously served as California's Attorney General for 6 years, and before that as District Attorney of San Francisco for 7 years. She's a graduate of Howard University, the historically black college. While Harris has been credited with pushing criminal justice reform in the Senate, she's been criticized for her record as a prosecutor in California by progressives, in part for her reluctance to prosecute police brutality cases. She once called herself California's top cop and wrote in 2009, quote, "If we take a show of hands of those who would like to see more police officers on the street, mine would shoot up." Biden's selection of Harris was celebrated by many progressive organizations. NAACP CEO Derek Johnson said the selection of Harris is, quote, "the culmination of the tireless work of Shirley Chisholm, Charlene Mitchell, Sojourner Truth, Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, Barbara Jordan, Ida B. Wells, and Merle Evers, and their fight for representation and equality," unquote. Sunrise Movement co-founder Varshini Prakash praised Harris for taking the no fossil fuel money pledge, endorsing the Green New Deal, and taking on big oil as California's attorney general. Former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders also praised Harris, tweeting, "She understands what it takes to stand up for working people, fight for health care for all, and take down the most corrupt administration in history." Meanwhile, at the White House, President Trump attacked Harris, describing her as, quote, "nasty." He made no mention of the fact he had twice donated to Harris's reelection bid to be California's attorney general in 2014. We're joined now by two guests. Joining us from Harris's hometown of Oakland, California, Amy Allison, president and founder of She the People, which has worked to elevate the political voice and leadership of women of color. Also with us, Breonna Joy Gray, former national press secretary for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. In 2019, she wrote a piece for The Intercept headlined, "A Problem for Kamala Harris: Can a Prosecutor Become President in the Age of Black Lives Matter?" We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Amy Allison, let's begin with you. Can you respond to Joe Biden's announcement yesterday that Kamala Harris will join him on the presidential ticket as his vice presidential running mate?
Well, it's hard to overstate how historic, how monumental this is. It's a watershed moment for women of color across the country. We've worked tirelessly over the last 3 years, but standing on the shoulders of women of color who have worked as engaged citizens and as the most loyal Democrats to lead. And for Kamala Harris to join the top of the ticket is not just a nod to our voting power, the necessity of women of color to turn out in historic numbers in November. It's an indication that the establishment in the Democratic Party, who just 4 years ago could not imagine women of color and black women being in executive leadership and in governance, now acknowledges that America needs the leadership of women of color. And so our time has come. It's a very exciting moment. And I've been hearing from women of color all over the country how thrilled they are. The move deepens the enthusiasm that women of color, particularly in battleground must-win states, feel about the Biden ticket, the Biden-Harris ticket. It's going to get people to be able to see themselves more deeply in the campaign. And that's going to bode well for a path to victory in November.
I'd like to ask Breonna Joy Gray your response to Vice President Biden's choice, and what message is he sending in terms of what sectors of the electorate he is courting or he is deciding that he doesn't need to placate with his vice presidential choice?
Yeah, I think there can be no doubt that, of course, this nomination is historic. But something else historic is going on right now, which is that we are in the middle of the largest protest movement in American history. And it's a protest movement that's all about finding non-punitive, non-carceral solutions to the kinds of economic problems that are plaguing disproportionately black and brown communities, but all Americans, especially right now in the middle of this additionally historic global pandemic. And so there's a great deal of frustration that there is this choice not only to nominate a candidate who is known as the author of what is actually called the Joe Biden crime bill, but that he's gone and also selected a running mate who is known for being the top cop from California, the state that has the second highest number of incarcerated people in America. And moreover, Kamala Harris is someone who has had these criticisms leveraged at her throughout, very early on, at the start of her campaign, and to many people in the activist community, has done very little to assuage people's concerns about her previous stances or demonstrate the level of growth that we would like to see. So I think that to the point that Ms. Allison was making about what whether or not that Black voters in swing states are going to be more inclined to turn out, what we saw from poll after poll is that Joe Biden had the base locked down, and he is often celebrating the fact that Black voters overwhelmingly voted for him. So it's not clear to me what the electoral value of this is when you contrast that, especially with the fact that younger voters in particular and swing voters are less enthusiastic about this campaign, in part because they were looking for a kind of fundamental change in this campaign cycle, a desire that was only exacerbated by the health crisis and economic crisis that we're in now. And Joe Biden has articulated very clearly that he is the candidate who promises that nothing will fundamentally change.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. That's Breonna Joy Gray, former National Press Secretary for Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential bid. And we're joined as well by Amy Allison, who is the founder of She the People. Stay with us. This All by Bobby Humphrey. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Joe Biden has selected Senator Kamala Harris of California to be his vice presidential running mate, making her the first Black woman and the first Indian American to be on a major party presidential ticket. Harris, the daughter of immigrants, her father from Jamaica, her mother from India. We're speaking with Amy Allison, president of She the People, and Breonna Joy Gray, former national press secretary for Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign and contributing editor to Current Affairs. Amy Allison, I wanted to ask about, well, Breonna's tweet yesterday. Just as the announcement came down, she tweeted, "We're in the midst of the largest protest movement in American history, the subject of which is excessive policing, and the Democratic Party chose a top cop and the author of Joe Biden crime bill to save us from Trump. The contempt for the base is wow." Amy Allison, your response.
I have so much respect for the analysis and the acknowledgement of the importance of the call for racial justice. There's no doubt that racial justice and issues dealing with America's racism is going to unify a multiracial coalition as we go into the polls. But here's what we understand about the base. Women of color, Black, Latina, Asian American, and Indigenous, form 25% of the voting base in several of the must-win key states, battleground states such as Arizona, Texas, Georgia, and Florida. We held a series of listening sessions over the last 6 weeks to ask women of color who lead voter engagement, voter registration, and movement building, organizational building on the ground, what they needed. Did they see themselves in the Biden campaign? What are the issues they care about? We heard loud and clear that there was an enthusiasm gap and that the vast majority of them wanted to see a woman of color on the ticket, and that the conversations and the engagement in the middle of a pandemic with voter suppression alive and well in those states, and the fact that we have a economic crisis where actually people are not able to afford their rent as of this month, all of those calamities were basically going to have to crawl through glass to be able to vote and get our votes counted. And having a woman of color on the ticket was part of that, but it wasn't the only thing. You know, the world doesn't rise and the sun doesn't rise and set on one candidate. Much of the excitement right now and how we translate the movement that we've been seeing, calling for Black Lives Matter and justice and a lot of the changes in policing that we've been in conversation with, are local issues. And what I'm hearing from battleground state folks is it isn't just the top of the ticket. It's also down ballot races. There are three women who are running for, who are Democratic nominees for Senate. There's an historic number of women of color running for Congress. But it's those local, the state legislative, city council races where the call to defund police will be translated into policy and budgets. That's where the fight is. And so it's not an either or. It's that we continue to push. My final point is, you know, Kamala Harris is not the same person as she was in 2011. She has a very progressive voting record as a senator. It's 2020. She showed up in this this historic pandemic time as an advocate for economic justice and for racial justice in the ways that are very promising. The movement has strength, and this is an indication of its influence.
And Breonna Gray, what about these this issue? One, that Kamala Harris has evolved as a political leader. The issue of the down ballot impact of this choice, and also the senator that you worked for, Senator Bernie Sanders. His advisor Chuck Rocha responded to Biden's pick by saying, "quote She's a good pick, a safe pick." Your response to that?
I think that I would agree with the fact that it's a safe pick, but I'm a little confused by the argument that this is the pick that's going to turn out Black women in particular for two reasons. One, because the reason that Black women are characterized as the base is because of our commitment to voting for the Democratic ticket, kind of regardless of who is on it. And that is, of course, a blessing and a curse. It is a blessing for the Democratic Party because there are all of these instances historically in which Black women have been the but-for factor to Democratic candidates being able to pull through against oftentimes truly heinous Republican alternatives. At the same time, it means that very little has to be done to appeal to Black voters. And we've seen a kind of indifference demonstrated by the Democratic Party that is increasing over the years. So I want to just note that, because I think it's important to say that there is a constituency that isn't as enthusiastic about Joe Biden's ticket right now, and that is younger voters, including younger Black voters, who are in a place where they're a little bit past representation being a be-all, end-all. And I'm, of course, not arguing that that's what Ms. Allison is saying here, but it is difficult to feel sometimes as a person of color, as a Black person in particular, that representational value is being elevated in these instances over your substantive political concerns. So my feeling here is that, yes, Kamala Harris has evolved, but that's also part of the concern here, that I think a lot of voters aren't exactly sure where she stands on a lot of these issues. And I think that's part of what was an issue for her during the primary. Remember that she dropped out before any ballots were cast before the California primary, speculation being that that was in part because she was losing her home state to Andrew Yang. So there is a lot of California-based local domestic concern about her from people who know her record the best. And there has been an implication online, at the very least, that the people who have raised concerns about Kamala Harris and her record are not the base, are not Black people, are white leftists. The Bernie bro mythology has been raised as a specter again, when the reality is there's a lot of grassroots frustration with the fact that this, again, unprecedented political movement is basically being ignored, or at very least a nose is being thumbed at what's going on in the streets right now.
I wanted to go to Donald Trump responding to Biden's choice of California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate.
She was probably nastier than even Pocahontas to Joe Biden. She was very disrespectful to Joe Biden.
That was what he said yesterday after he heard the news. Amy Allison, you're also part of a group called We Have Your Back. And I was wondering if you can talk about this. First, his response, and also want to get Brianna's response to what he said. And this, of course, his slur against Elizabeth Warren in the same breath. But also, what you're demanding of the media now as this campaign moves forward.
Donald Trump set the stage even when he was campaigning in 2016. His attack of on black women in particular, women of color, has been pointed. It's part of what he does. It's how he rallies a racist base of voters, and it's red meat to his supporters. Let me just tell you and be very clear. Black women and women of color were never confused about who Donald Trump is. We voted in record numbers against him in 2016, and we will, despite the fact that we face a lot of challenges voting and getting our votes counted. What he says does not matter. The issue, though, with We Got Your Back is bigger than party. It's bigger than Trump. It's that this country, although the base of the Democratic Party in recent polls has demonstrated that they want a black woman in leadership. And so now we have a black woman at the top of the ticket, a woman of color at the top of the ticket. Despite that, racist and sexist comments dismissing the readiness of many of the women of color, particularly black women who are being vetted for VP, already had started. And it wasn't just from Republicans. It also came from quarters like former Senator Chris Dodd. So what we have to do is be vigilant. We learned a lot from the attacks on Hillary Clinton as a white woman running for president. We know that the racist and sexist attacks are going to continue fast and furious against Senator Harris and other women who are standing for leadership. So what we ask for the media is to focus on the issues, is to not tolerate headlines like they had in L.A. Times, which is likening Kamala Harris to receiving a rose and on the island and silly things like that. I don't want any conversation about her hair or her clothes. What are the issues? What are we trying to do with this country? What are the essential values of the political game? What is the plan? And when we take the conversation, particularly for women of color, away from characterizing, you know, the personal attributes and dismissing women of color with words like ambitious and, you know, holding women of color to a different standard, we actually get a better political result. So in all what we're doing as women of color and broadly as we're leading a larger movement to create political space for women of color to lead, not just Senator Harris, but women of color everywhere. We are the fastest growing voting bloc. We are the most underrepresented at every level of government. And for us to be able to assert ourselves in a multiracial democracy, we have to push back hard against racism and sexist attacks and celebrate and uplift our ability to and willingness to govern.
I wanted to ask both of you about we've heard the preliminary lineup for the Democratic convention next week, and your sense of the focus of the Democratic Party being largely the Obamas, the Clintons, and of course Jill Biden and Joe Biden as the main speakers at the key hours when all the national networks are tuned in. I'm wondering your response to the big tent of the party. Why, for instance, Bernie Sanders is not being given a more prominent speaking role in this convention? Is that signaling something to that same expanded Democratic base?
Well, first, I want to echo what Ms. Allison has said about there being no excuse for using racism or sexism to criticize Kamala Harris or any other female candidates or candidates of color. At the same time, evoking the example of Hillary Clinton, I think part of the issue there was that there was a mixed bag of substantive complaints and sexist concerns. And I would hate for us to fall in the same trap that the party fell into in 2016 and dismissing both in tandem, instead of taking and addressing a lot of those substantive concerns head on in a way that it could have helped Hillary Clinton assuage the concerns of her critics and unify a party that much of which felt ultimately gaslit and ignored. And I don't think anybody here thinks that the substantive criminal justice concerns in particular that have been lobbied at Kamala Harris are sexist. And already we've seen some of that characterized that way. So Amy Allison raised this idea of calling her ambitious as a sexist slur. No doubt that some people are characterizing that that way, but there's also a very legitimate criticism of her choice to pursue a career as a prosecutor, in part because it's a very commonly known way to advance oneself politically when you have a background as a lawyer. And I say that as an attorney myself. With respect to the Democratic National Convention, you know, I think the party is sending a very clear signal about whose votes they are reaching for and whose they aren't. They have John Kasich, who is a Republican and who has attempted to pass some of the most draconian anti-abortion laws in the state of Ohio in a prime spot when there was news for a while that that suggested that they weren't even going to allow AOC to speak. Of course, they now have, but they have made gestures like barring the Young Turks, one of the preeminent lefty news organizations, from having a press pass to a digital event. Why you would do that other than to send a kind of signal to progressives that you're not interested in their vote, I don't know. So it's a really curious choice. It feels, again, like it's 2016, and there is a dynamic being set up where there is a kind of wanton disregard for the values and interests of what is coming up to be the new base, the insurgent left wing of the party, the part of the party that just celebrated the victory of Cori Bush last week, and Jamal Bowman and Mondaire Jones. And it is telling that the only people under the age of 40, under the age of 50, rather, who are speaking at this event are AOC and Pete Buttigieg.
Now, I wanted to ask very quickly, Brianna, about Medicare for All, an absolutely key position. Recently, the Platform Committee, the Democratic Party, voted 125-36 to reject the single-payer plan during a virtual meeting they had. Now, Senator Kamala Harris has taken an unusual position on this. First, when asked in the presidential debate how she feels about Medicare for All, she raised her hand in support, but the next day took it back. Can you explain her position, though, was co-sponsor of Bernie Sanders' bill?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people struggle to explain her position, which I fundamentally think is what her issue was in failing to get more traction in the general election. I truly thought she was going to be the most difficult candidate to beat. But you saw over and over again that she would make a kind of strong claim on the debate stage and then ratchet it back in the spin room or in the day in the days and interviews afterwards. So, look, I think that the silver lining to this is that Kamala Harris was one of the early co-signers of Bernie Sanders' 2017 Medicare for All bill. Her Medicare for All plan, although ambiguous in some respects, is most certainly to the left of Joe Biden's plan. So I'm curious to see if the media will ask her and Joe Biden to define what's going on in the space between the two and how Kamala Harris is reconciling her acknowledgement that healthcare is a human right, her acknowledgement that, especially during the time of this pandemic, that people should not have to pay for healthcare to survive, that the employer-based healthcare system has been revealed as a complete failure in a world where we're seeing record unemployment rates that, of course, are disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities, and more so the actual COVID infection rates are, of course, affecting Black and brown communities disproportionately. How are you going to reconcile all of that with Joe Biden's obstinate insistence that even if Medicare for All were to be passed, were to pass the House and Senate, that he would veto that bill? And perhaps there are opportunities for leverage there for the left.
Thank you both for being with us. Of course, this is a conversation that is going to continue. And Democracy Now! Is there all week next week, of course, virtually. On Democracy Now!, we'll be bringing you the Democratic National Convention coverage each day, bringing you highlights of the evening's events and commentary as well. We want to thank Brianna Joy Gray, former National Press Secretary for Bernie Sanders 2020. presidential campaign and a contributing editor to Current Affairs, as well as Amy Allison, president of She the People, speaking to us from Kamala Harris's hometown of Oakland, California. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we talk to the award-winning author of Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. Stay with us.
That race founded on two-thirds a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial. Squeezed economics, subsistence survival. Deafening silence and social control. Black rage is found in all wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the bees sting, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Black rage is founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse, while we waited and waited. Spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things.
Black Rage by Lauryn Hill. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez is with us from New Jersey. And we're spending the rest of the hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Isabel Wilkerson, whose new book actually grows out of her widely acclaimed book, The Warmth of Other Suns, which tells the history of the Great Migration when waves of African Americans moved out of the South to escape racism, only to face it again in the North. Well, in her new book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents, Wilkerson argues that based on her extensive research, America's racial hierarchy should be thought of as a caste system, similar to what she calls the world's most recognized caste system in India. She also looks at how Nazi Germany borrowed from Jim Crow laws of the United States. They were not Hitler's model. Wilkerson writes, quote, searching the histories of all three hierarchies and poring over a wealth of studies on caste across many disciplines, I began to compile the parallels in a more systematic way and identified the essential shared characteristics of these hierarchies, what I call the eight pillars of caste, traits disturbingly present in all of them. Isabel Wilkerson, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. But I want to start by asking you about what just happened here in this country. You know, you write in your book about Dr. Martin Luther King's month-long visit to India, when he visited with high school students whose families had been so-called untouchables, and how he was then called one. And that relates directly to Joe Biden's choice as his vice presidential candidate, his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris. She becomes now the first woman of color to be nominated for national office by a major political party. She is the daughter of immigrants. She is African-American, her father from Jamaica, and her mother from India. So she's the first Indian-American to be nominated, as well as African-American. If you can comment on the significance of this.
Well, the significance of this is that so many long have been overcome or have been crossed moment to have someone who is the first woman of color, the first woman of African descent, the first woman of Indian descent to be nominated for a major party, phenomenal moment. And to think about how many barriers had to be crossed, it's taken 244 years to get to this day.
We're going to go right now to the visit that you write about in Caste, that visit that Martin Luther King made to the state of Kerala in India. He was there in India for a month. He visited with high school students whose families had been untouchables. Well, in a speech to the Los Angeles World Affairs Council in February of 1965, Dr. King describes his visit and the introduction that was given of him by the principal.
As he came to the end of his introduction, he said, "I would like to present to you a fellow untouchable from the United States of America." And for the moment, I was peeved, I was shocked that I would be introduced as an untouchable. But pretty soon, my mind ran back across to America. And I started thinking about the fact that there were so many places that I couldn't go because of the color of my skin. I started thinking about the fact that my 20 million brothers and sisters in the Negro community of America are still at the bottom of the economic ladder, deprived of adequate housing conditions, unable to live in numerous neighborhoods because of the color of their skin. I started thinking about the fact that my little children were still judged on the basis of the color of their skin rather than the content of their character. And I had to say to myself, I am an untouchable. And every Negro in the United States is an untouchable.
That is Dr. Martin Luther King speaking in 1965 about his 1959 visit to India. Isabel Wilkerson, you write magnificently about this journey and how you came to look at this country like others look at India, talking about the centrality of caste. Tell us more about Dr. King's visit to India.
Well, he had arrived in 1959, obviously inspired by the country and by the leadership of Mohandas K. Gandhi, who had inspired his nonviolent approach to freeing African Americans from the grip of what he ultimately would identify as a caste system in his own country, in the United States. And so he arrived to visit the school. And as we so eloquently heard his reciting, recalling that experience, it at first, when he was identified or he was introduced to the children, to the students there, as an untouchable, the word landed a little oddly for him because he hadn't thought of himself in that way. And as he considered and scrolled back into his memories of and experiences and recognition of all of the things that had been restricted for both him and the 20 million other African Americans that he was fighting for, he himself, Dr. King, recognized that America had beneath its infrastructure a caste system that was not as different from India as we might like to believe.
And Isabel Wilkerson, first of all, I want to congratulate you on such a marvelously written book, just as your earlier book was so marvelously written. And I wanted to ask you about a particular section of it where you write, caste is the bone, race is the skin. Caste is fixed and rigid. Race is fluid and superficial, subject to periodic redefinition to meet the needs of the dominant caste in what is now the United States. If you could expound for those of our readers who, of our viewers who haven't read your book yet, this relationship that you try to delve into between caste and race.
Well, first I want to say that I came to the concept of race through the first book that I wrote, The Warmth of the Suns, in which I was writing about the flight of 6 million African Americans who were escaping the Jim Crow South. And in writing about what they had endured, writing about what the Jim Crow South was actually like, a lot of Americans have not really gotten that true exposure to what it was like to live in that world where everything that you could do or could not do was based upon what you looked like, that it was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to play checkers together. So I was recreating that world. And recreating that world, I did not use the word racism because it did not seem sufficient to capture the totality of and the comprehensive nature of the control, restrictions, and boundaries. So I came to the So that calls upon us to think about, well, what does caste mean? What is caste? So caste system essentially is an arbitrary grading, an artificial grading, graded ranking of human value in a society. And it's one in which there's a fixed infrastructure that in our country predates anyone who's alive today. It goes all the way back to colonial times when the country was being formed. And a caste system essentially determines one's standing, the respect accorded a person, the benefit of the doubt, access to resources, or the deprivation of access to those resources, even such things as assumptions of competence and beauty. So this is the hierarchy that we have all inherited, that no one alive created, but we have inherited it, and we live under the shadow of that system.
You also write about what you call the middle castes of Asians, Latinos, indigenous people, and new immigrants of African descent, who you say navigate within what began as a bipolar hierarchy. I'm wondering if you could explain that, and also why you chose to include indigenous people in the middle caste, when some would argue that certainly in the United States and certainly in Latin America, there has been a long existing caste system toward the native peoples, whether it's in Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Mexico, and of course, in the United States. So why you felt that the indigenous people should be included among this middle caste?
Well, first of all, the caste system, as I'm describing it, we have to go back to where it began. It began with the creation of a country in which the people who were the colonists, who were British, placed themselves obviously at the top of the hierarchy, and then brought people in from Africa to be the enslaved people, who would automatically, by definition, be at the very bottom of the caste system, having no rights whatsoever, not even rights over their own bodies. And so there also were, of course, the indigenous people who were the First Nations of this land, who then were in some ways exiled from the caste system that was being created as in a bipolar caste system. So in many respects, and I also say that they are in some ways outside, forced to be outside of the caste system in the ways that the colonists devised it by forcing them off of their land. The bipolar caste system is meant that there were basically two main groups that were the foundation as the country created. And then anyone entering this bipolar caste system then had to figure out where did they fit in, had to somehow navigate what had been created as a two-tiered system. And the infrastructure that had been created had to also decide, you know, assigned people to roles on the basis primarily of what they looked like and what their lineage might have been, what part of the world did they come from. So when people were arriving, say, from Europe, they were not, from outside of Northern Europe, they were not necessarily thinking of themselves as white. The white was not a label that had been applied or needed to be applied, I should say, to someone who was living in 16th century of what would now be Ireland or Hungary or Poland. In other words, people who were arriving to the United States in the early decades and even century of history in the United States were not arriving as white people in their minds. They were arriving as Irish or Polish or Hungarian. Upon arrival, though, they were assigned to the category, essentially a new category. The idea of race is a fairly new one, going back only about 500 years, race as we currently know it. So they had to then navigate and readjust their identity in order to meet the expectations of this caste system that they were entering. And so did other people who were coming from other parts of the world. The United States in the late 19th century and early 20th century went to a great deal of trouble to curate its population, particularly those who were not coming from Northern Europe. And so anyone coming from outside of Northern Europe then had to be fit into this caste system. And that meant that there was a tremendous amount of
disillusion and a tremendous amount of restlessness about trying to figure out who would fit. So there were a lot of legal challenges of people coming from Asia, people coming from other parts of the world to petition for the recognition of citizenship, petition ultimately for the recognition of being able to fit into what was the category of the dominant caste, which would have been white or Caucasian at that time. And so this is a work in progress. It's always been a work in progress. And so anyone coming in from outside of what these polls that were arbitrary, random designations of human beings, ended up having to find a way to navigate. And it created this stressor, these stressors and tensions between groups as they tried to figure out how to survive in an often forbidding bipolar structure.
And you bring in Nazi Germany, Isabel Wilkerson. If you can explain how it was the United States and the Jim Crow laws that inspired the Nazis. Explain how that all fits together with caste.
Well, I have to say that my main focus in the beginning was to look for the parallels or the intersections, the point of intersections that would help us understand our own countries, primarily focused on the United States, but to help us understand our own country through what we might learn from how other countries have managed their hierarchies. And what brought me to Germany was actually Charlottesville, and that was there in the protests against the potential removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee, that the ralliers themselves displayed the symbols of the Confederacy and the Nazi party, the Nazis, in this one space. We saw the pageantry of the symbols coming together over the issues of memory of the Civil War, memory of slavery, memory of American history in general. And so the ralliers there are the ones that put these two together, these two symbols together, these two cultures together. And that was the reason why I decided to look more closely at Germany. I was looking primarily to find out how had they managed understand, re-educate themselves and the society, atone for what had happened during World War II. How had they remembered what had happened? And so the deeper I looked, it turned out that I discovered things that I never would have imagined. One of them had having to do with the fact that German eugenicists were in contact with, in continuing dialogue with, American eugenicists in the years and decades leading up to the Third Reich, that American eugenicists wrote books that were big sellers in Germany in the years leading up to the Third Reich. Now, the Nazis needed no one to teach them how to hate. They absolutely needed no inspiration for how to hate or how to enact that hate. But what they did was they sent researchers to the United States to study the Jim Crow laws here in the United States, to study and to research how the United States had managed to subordinate and subjugate its African-American population. They sent people to research the anti-miscegenation laws. They sent them to understand and to study the segregation laws. And then they went back and they debated the American laws in the run up to creating what would ultimately become the Nuremberg laws. These were just stunning and wrenching things to discover in the process of this work.
We only have 30 seconds left, Isabel Wilkerson, but you relate the story of talking to Gwen Ifill at a party, being deeply concerned. This is before the presidency of Donald Trump, that he would win. And you cited 2042. Why?
I mentioned 2042 because that is the year that was projected in 2008 by the census as to be the year that the demographics of the United States would change to a configuration that no one in the country of any in any space had ever imagined. And that would be where the historic white majority would no longer be the majority. And that, in fact, the configuration that we've known for all of American history would be changing. And that has an impact on everyone in the hierarchy, everyone in the country, everyone in society, to try to figure out how do we work toward a space in which everyone can feel seen and feel that they are recognized as citizens in this country.
Well, Isabel Wilkerson, we're going to do part two of this interview, of this incredible book, past, the origins of our discontents. Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and winner of the National Humanities Medal. Part two coming up at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.